Okay. Questions? Oh, lots of questions. People have been thinking too much. How to deal with excessive thinking when meditating? Answer, stop asking questions. Excessive thinking. We give too much importance to thinking and not enough importance to just being here. In other words, just go for a walk in the forest or just around the area here and feel just the sensation of your bare feet on the concrete or on the grass. Feel the wind in your face. Don't think about stuff. Be in reality, because thinking is one step away from reality. And just listen to the sounds, because you can't be listening to the sounds and thinking at the same time. Thinking is like talking back to the world, and instead we listen to life instead of talking back at her. So this is where we... instead of thinking. So in those few moments you were quiet. You were not thinking, because you never knew when I was going to start speaking again. Isn't it beautiful to have those moments when you are, but not thinking, not giving it a name, not interfering? The beautiful silence of life. So listen for the silence and don't talk back. Little by little, you will find that you get more and more peaceful. And as you get more and more silent, noticing the silence which is always here, between your thoughts, it becomes so beautiful, so enticing. You could even get attached to silence, which is a much better thing than being attached to thinking. So just learn how to listen, to feel, to be, without trying to work it all out. And again, wisdom is always comes from silence, never through thinking. Thinking only gets you more arguments. So take the importance away from thinking and give it to silence. Once you have opened the lotus through jhana, do you then learn to open it without jhana, but present moment awareness, not fixed on an object? Do arahats have this lotus always open, or just understand how it functions? Oh my goodness, a lot of thinking there. I'm going to talk about the lotus tomorrow morning. So when I put things in here, please leave them in there. This is my keeping for tomorrow box. So what it means is you don't open the lotus. The lotus is opens by itself through kindness and awareness. That's not what you do. That's what happens when you don't do stuff. You're aware and you're kind. It opens just by itself. And I will say more tomorrow about how you go even deeper into the lotus through the jhanas and find out what happens next. The jewel in the heart of the lotus, which is a good translation of Om Mani Padme Hum. That is coming tomorrow. Well, I didn't have any bad intention to hurt your feelings. Therefore, not my fault, but I'm sorry that you feel that way. Even though you had no bad intention, shouldn't you be reflecting on what you have done? If the result is negative and someone, he or she, got hurt by your actions? You know, sometimes that we always pass the blame onto other people. So I didn't have any bad intention to hurt your feelings. Therefore, it's not my fault, but I'm sorry that you feel that way. You know that if you take responsibility for everybody's reactions, you're one of these people who always want to please others, and it's so tense, it's impossible. So instead, you know, we learn to say that indeed you didn't have any bad intentions to hurt your feelings. Therefore, not my fault, but I'm sorry that you feel that way. Even if you had no bad intentions, you shouldn't be reflecting on what you have done. No, the person should be reflecting on how they reacted. Sometimes a dog barks just when you're about to get into jhana. It's that dog's fault. That dog should reflect. Just, you know, to look there with, you know, big stupid eyes and wagging its tail, that's not good enough. But the point is that we always want to control the world. Always put the fault onto others. If we don't put it onto others, we put it onto ourselves. So how I was taught by Ajahn Chah, he would say, if someone's hurt your feelings and you go and blame them, why do you say that? You should reflect on it. Be a bit more careful next time. Then that's like having an itch on your head and scratching your bum. He had a way of putting things which was, you know, unforgettable. And who would actually do that? Have an itch on your head and you scratch your bottom, you get two itches for the price of one. So where the itch is, that's where you've got to scratch it. Where is the problem? The problem is in you. So you learn how to when somebody offends you, be someone who can't be offended. Why do I like other people to upset my happiness, steal my happiness? You have a choice. When I was young, you used to say, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That's what you used to say, and you used to actually practice that. What Ajahn Chah used to say, someone calls you a dog, he said, look at your bottom. What's that got to do with it? See if you've got a tail. If you haven't got a tail, I'm not a dog. End of problem. So in other words, we don't allow people to control our happiness, other people. You do have that choice not to get offended. And that way, you're at peace. So if you try and rely upon others and get them to never offend you, never hurt you, then it's impossible. It will never work. You're just trying to get all the dogs not to bark, to get all of the mosquitoes never to bite, to get all of the people in your cottage never to snore, to get all of the husbands who always are there for you whenever you want them, and the wives always to be kind to you, the monks always to be wise and there for you any time, whatever, always be able to smile whenever you have a photograph taken. It takes a lot of training. So, the point is, you're asking from this world what it can't give you. People will say things which you have a choice to allow yourself to be hurt or not to be hurt. You have that choice. Exercise that. Is mindfulness of anicca, anatta, dukkha out of place, too much thinking and meditation on the breath? When objects other than the breath slide into the center of our screen, is this another method best for bringing the breath back? It can be, but just don't overdo it. And sometimes, for example, you're doing, say, breath meditation, anicca, because sometimes we don't really understand what anicca is. I'll be saying later on, it's not just rise and fall, it's when things disappear, totally, gone, poof. And anatta, do you really understand what anatta is? Sometimes all out there is anatta, but what in here is okay. Dukkha, we always try and keep a little bit, a tiny bit, where we can exist and there's no suffering anymore. So, we people have all these ideas of like an original mind, a cosmic consciousness, a ground of all being where we can actually be. happy ever after, the ultimate retirement home, the Walt Disney myth. You find the Nibbana which is meant for you, and together you and Nibbana ride off into the sunset, happy ever after. We always look for that happy ever after myth. But the Buddha saw through that. So sometimes you don't really understand what dukkha is. So because of that, it's much better. You can use it for skillful means, just to see if it works, to see if you can actually get more peaceful. In other words, something comes in on the center of your screen, now this too will pass. That's a little bit of adicca. So, you know, you're upset, or you're tired, or you're restless, it's going to pass anyway. So if you're sick, what Ajahn Chah used to say, you'll either get better or you'll die. Then it passes, so it doesn't really matter, does it? Any noise, it just disappears. So any jokes, I'll soon stop telling them when I die. So that's something which you can do. So it's okay to do a little bit, but don't do too much. Don't interrupt too much. Should we meditate every day, even when we are tired from working full-time with the kids and home to take care of? Would it be effective to meditate when we are tired? Otherwise, when is the best time to meditate? When is the best time to meditate? Answer, now. When is the worst time to meditate? Later. If you follow that advice. But the thing is, what is meditation? Meditation is not, I have to get jhanas. Meditation is making peace, being kind, being gentle. It's not what you're achieving. It's, you know, what you're doing, or rather what you're not doing. It's not what you're experiencing. I'll say this later on. Your meditation object is not as important as how you relate to it. It's how you relate to it. Are you making peace with it, being kind, being gentle? Are you getting attached to it, trying to get rid of something? Trying to want something, getting excited or afraid with it, how are you reacting to what you're experiencing? That is the essence of the path. You're just making what I call good meditation karma. What you got now is here. Tiredness, pain, sickness, kids, whatever. Here they are. The other thing I don't know about having kids, I've got, how many monks over in Bunyan Monastery, about 20 kids over there. How many daughters have I got? How many have I wanted to see? So anyway, so what you do is, yeah, you have these things, but it's how you relate to them, what you do with them. One of the things which you do, you don't possess children. It's only temporary. I'm only a temporary abbot. Part-time. Casual labour. Not a permanent job. So, what do you mean by that? Now, what I mean by that I do take time being a visitor, not being an owner. So, there are days when I go to Bodhinyana Monastery, and I am not the abbot that day. So people come and ask me, oh, can I ask you a question? Sorry, abbot's not here today. Oh, but I need to get questions on meditation. Sorry, I'm only a visitor. Oh, they need to the water pipe's broken. Or that stupid thing on the fire hydrant is something is going off. Beep, beep, beep. I'm only a visitor. Because when you're a visitor, you can actually let it go. You can just enjoy Bodhinyana Monastery. Many of you have been over there and said, oh, it's such a peaceful, beautiful monastery. And people used to say that to me, it's so peaceful. So, what are you talking about peaceful? There's so many people over there just want to come and see me, ask questions. If not the people, the monks. If not the monks, somebody makes an email. If not the email, that someone else wants to bother me. Unfair. So for me, that's my workplace. And if I'm the owner, oh, there's so much stuff to do. Just like in your house. If you own your house, There's always jobs to be done. But if you just visit, then you don't have to do any jobs. How many of you, when you visit somebody else's house, how many of you mow the lawn for them? How many of you wash the dishes for them? Well, you're not visiting here as part of your duties here, but if you come to that, somebody invites you for dinner, you don't wash the dishes for them afterwards. That's their job. You're just visiting. A visitor has just no responsibilities, no duties. So to get a rest, even in the monastery, where I'm supposed to be the abbot, the boss, I pretend to be a visitor sometimes. I'm visiting today, so no responsibility. Just let it go. It's very important, because otherwise I could not appreciate the monastery in which I live. For you it's beautiful and peaceful, but if you own it and have responsibility for it, you've got so much stuff to do, oh, it's very busy. So I decided to look at the monastery in which I live just like you do, with your eyes, someone who's visiting. And that changes the whole perception of it. And then I look at my body. Oh, it's tired. Oh, it's hot. Oh, it's cold. So, okay, I'm only visiting this body. So it doesn't really matter so much. I don't take so much responsibility for it. And my mind, it's not really my mind. I'm just visiting. So it's none of my business. Some was about a year ago. Somebody, they told me in the interviews here, that their kid, about 14 or 15, they were asking their kids, sort of, have you cleaned up your room yet? And he said to his mum, Nanya. And she never heard that before, so she let it go. Have you done your homework? Nanya. And have you taken out the trash? Nanya. And said, yeah, what do you mean? What's this word Nanya? What does it stand for? And the son said, oh, you know, it's just, you know, teenage speak. It means Nanya business. But I took that on board. I thought, oh, what a great word that is. So if people ask me, you know, Ajahn Brahm, are you enlightened? I say, Nanya. Have you, what else am I supposed to be doing? Have you written an article for the magazine yet? Nanya. So it's nice. Just, and this is not being rude. It's just sometimes you need time off to realize you're not an owner. So my meditation is none of my business. Isn't that wonderful? So when I go back to my room, oh, you meditators here, none of your business. So I'm sorry, but I forget about you. So I can just meditate and have a good time. While I'm in front of you, there, you are my business. But later on, I just disappear. So that's actually how we let go. That's how, when you're working full time with kids at home to take care of, I don't know how old your kids. Sometimes they'd look after themselves. This, all these lovely little stories collected over the years. This woman had two small kids, maybe 5 and 7 or something, and she always tried to meditate at home. So she would sit down. She'd only be sitting down for 1 minute, and they'd climb over her. She had long hair, pull her hair. Mummy, 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 I need to go poo. Mummy, mummy, I need a glass of water. Mummy, mummy, mummy. And she would always get up. But then one day she told me, right, this is it. I'm not going to move. So they crawled all over her, pulled her ears, pulled her hair. That never worked. So she kept sitting there. And it's amazing just how innovative young kids could be. Mummy, mummy, Joe has got the knife out of the kitchen table. Mummy, mummy, Christina's turned on the gas. And I just really admire this mother. She said, I don't care. You can blow each other up. You can carve each other to shreds. I'm just going to meditate. So she just meditated there. She didn't. It was none of her business. None of it. She wasn't a mother now. She was just having a nice quiet time by herself. Time out. And then she meditated for half an hour. And now things got very quiet, so she wasn't really quite sure whether they killed one another or what. But when she opened her eyes, of course they hadn't killed one another, they hadn't blown up the house, they were just sitting quietly praying in the corner. And from that time on, she could always meditate. You know, she sat down there and the kids realized there's no way they could get their mum out of meditation. And they appreciated that she was a much nicer mum after she had half an hour free of them. So they appreciated that. So he was just a wise mother. So, and trusted their kids. The kids were just, you know, trying to threaten you, but they would never go through with it. Ajahn, I heard that during meditation, everything that looks solid disintegrates. Is this how things really are? Is the solidity of things an illusion? Yes, sort of. I remember this through science, through physics. Just what you're sitting on now appears so solid. But, you know, what actually is it? It's just molecules. Those molecules, the spaces between the molecules. Now, what is actually really there? It's 99.9999999% nothing. Actually, more than that. And just the atoms, the spaces between atoms. It's 99.99999, I think about 26 nines, nothing. And even in an atom, you've got this little electron circling around. This is the old style idea. The nucleus, and it's 99.99999% nothing. And you keep looking at it, there's actually nothing really there. Total nothing. But it's just the forces. It's not the things, but the way they relate to one another. The way that particles interact. There's no such thing as fundamental particles, really, because they're never stable. But there's fundamental forces. The way that they interact. It's the way that you interact with things, not the things themselves, which is a fundamental part of nature. Da da da. You want to work that one out? Sometimes I say these things and just, I'll try to stop you go thinking. I'll make you think even more now. When I get to meditation, I feel something circulating, pushing and releasing kind of motion on my forehead between the eyebrows. Is this normal? Absolutely abnormal. We're going to send you into the... No, we're not going to send you anywhere. Of course it's normal. Most of meditation, sometimes listening to you also, I feel this. What is it? Oh, just some circulating, pushing motion on the forehead between the eyebrows. Just let it happen. It could be all sorts of things, but it's not important. What is important is how you relate to that. Are you afraid? You try and stop it. You try and let it be. You know, it's just part of nature. Just let it happen. And if you react to it, you'll find it just gets worse and it gets a huge thing. If you just say, oh, just the door of my heart is open to this circulating motion. Meditation can be boring sometimes, but this makes it interesting and fascinating. I wonder if I can make it go faster. Come on. I wonder if I can actually make it go slower. I wonder if I can expand it. I wonder if I can get, I've never actually seen this, but apparently there was this movie after I became a monk called The Exorcist. Wonder if I can get it to go the right way around. That would be so cool. So when you have fun with it, rather than being afraid of it, you find it vanishes pretty quickly. What's most important is not what you're experiencing, but how you experience it. Whether it's with wanting, ill will, fear, delusion, all of those negative reactions, calculation, defilements, or is it with the positive ones? The door of my heart's open to you, weirdness. Come in. Then it vanishes. I'm having a wonderful time. Why are you asking a question for? Okay, anyway. My mind is gradually settling down. My question, I am in a loving relationship. How does one keep to the... I'm in a loving relationship as well. With myself and my teddy bear. Sometimes, to be able to love another, you need to learn how to love yourself. To be kind to yourself. To be forgiving. Not trying to change people. So anyway, that's a loving relationship. You learn a lot about how to, what is in a relationship. How does one keep the Noble Eightfold Path, further meditation practice, while keeping the passion alive and taking care of business? I'm a very passionate monk. I am a passionate monk. Compassion and dispassion. There's my two passions in life. I'm sure there's something other passion somewhere or other. So, how to keep the passion alive and taking care of the business? Look, it's if you're in a relationship. Look, just before I came here in the afternoon, Friday afternoon, was a marriage ceremony. I did this whole little skillful means. Looked into amazing they didn't hear it, or they forgot it from, they'd been listening to me before. I said, now you're a married man. It was Peter, his name, and Viola. Peter, you're a married man now, you must not think of yourself. Yep. Viola, you're a married woman now, it's not about you anymore, you mustn't think of yourself. Yep. Viola, now you're a married woman, you must not think of that guy, Peter, your husband. And Peter, you're a married man now, you mustn't think of your wife, you mustn't think of Viola anymore. And if you haven't heard this before, it's a wonderful teaching technique because you confuse people. And then they pay attention. What's the answer to the riddle? And the riddle answer is so important. Once you're married, you mustn't think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. There's a third way. You think of us. It's not about me anymore, nor is it about them. It's about us. If it's about me in a marriage, then it's just so selfish, it's not much of a relationship at all. It's just what I can get out of it. If it's about giving to your partner, you get burnt out. There's nothing in it for you again. And people get confused, so what's the answer? And the answer is, it's about us. So whose problem is it? Our problem. And if it's our problem, so many problems you can solve. That's why in interviews, people were talking about, what about this Hinayana and Mahayana and Vajrayana business? Ajahn Brahm, are you a Bodhisattva? Sacrificing your enlightenment for others? No way. Are you Hinayana, just trying to become enlightened yourself? No way. Because Hinayana, when it's just about me. And Mahayana, Bodhisattva, is about you. We have the third option, about us. We're in it together. So the idea of, this Hinayana, Mahayana dichotomy, it's just no way. It's all just Buddhism. So, that's how you take care of it. How do you deal with sexual thoughts as they come up in your meditative practice? Let go. Because sexual thoughts, craving thoughts, for some people it's the best happiness they have. But when you get into meditation, it's even much better than that. So we have a much better sort of happiness. So, please excuse me, but sexuality, it's a wonderful being a monk. I wasn't born a monk. I'm very fortunate that, I had girlfriends, had sex. So I have some idea. I had long relationships, one for about 6 months. That's long enough, come on. But none of that was anywhere near as nice as just having, nice deep meditation. So as a monk, you can leave any time. You don't have to stay as a monk. So the reason I stay as a monk, because you're enjoying it. So beautiful. Free. The relationship with everybody, or with nobody, with us. Yoga activity to strengthen and care for the body seems to help my mindfulness and ability to sit without pain. Why is this not encouraged? It's not encouraged, not discouraged. Sure, you can do some yoga. But I did see some dangers in yoga, and I did send that little video clip to, where's Dimmy? Dimmy, you're supposed to be here somewhere. Oh, there you are. Remember that video clip I sent to you? It was funny, wasn't it? Maybe I can, she's shaking her head. It's a bit gross, but you know, it's my sense of humour. But anyway, so yeah, you can do some yoga, no problem at all. Is it because in the Buddha's time they didn't have bad backs from sitting in chairs for most of their life? Is this kind of practice too sensually focused? No, if it works, you can do it. So no, yoga is fine. When the breath becomes beautiful and metta strong, I can feel elated and can see it makes problems, etc. Thinking, distraction. How is this best approached? When the breath becomes beautiful, don't disturb it. It's going so wonderful, so just enjoy. Because when you start to think about it, you disturb it. There is one of the stories about silence. This is from the Taoist tradition. Long time ago, I don't know if this is how true this is, but it's a good story anyway. Lao Tzu had a sort of a monastery and training many people, and he would allow one student to go on a walk with him, so it's every evening. Quite a long walk. But the student had to keep silent. It was a golden rule. You weren't allowed to speak. So he chose a new student, go for a walk, you know, through the forest. They came to a ridge in the mountains at sunset. And there was one of these most amazing golden, red, crimson streaks of incredible beauty, sunset. And the student forgot the vow and blurted out, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." He'd broken the rule. And Lao Tzu turned around. He didn't say you've broken the rule, because you know, he would have broken the rule as well. So Lao Tzu turned around, walked back to the monastery. When they got back, he said, "You know, you broke the rule. For the rest of your life, you will not be allowed to go on a walk with me again." And his friend said, "That's a bit harsh. And he just made a mistake. And anyway, what's wrong? What's wrong with saying what a beautiful sunset?" And this is the reason I say this little anecdote, because Lao Tzu's answer was just amazing. He said, "As soon as my student said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was watching the words." You get that? If you say, "What a beautiful sunset," you're watching the description, the words. You're not watching the sunset anymore. So that's why we try and keep quiet. So you've got beautiful breath. Because if you start getting elated and start thinking, then you're not watching the beautiful breath anymore. You're watching the thoughts, the descriptions. So when you understand what's going on, you say, "Crikey, it's such a beautiful breath, I'm going to just stay with this." You don't even say that with words. You just stay there. "You mentioned your friend who disrobed. What was the difference? How did you find the strength to continue when he did not?" "Oh, I was too lazy to get a job. You know, going 9 to 5. Being a monk, much nicer." You know why Ajahn Chah became a monk? I think I told this a few days ago, but I heard this from him. You know, sometimes people say, "Ajahn Brahm, you should be more serious." And say, "No, what about Ajahn Chah? Was he serious?" This is when they ask Ajahn Chah, "Why did you become a monk?" He said, "Well, you know, I grew up in a poor village in the northeast of Thailand. And in the village, we didn't have any things like TVs or radios. So just like in the old days, that you should make up your own games with your friends in the village, people of your own age. And one of the favorite games they had was playing the game of monks. So one of them would volunteer to be a monk, you know, about 5 or 6 years of age, and that would always be Ajahn Chah, you know, the future Ajahn Chah. He said, "Oh, I'll volunteer to be the monk." So he'd go to his house and get a sort of anything which looked a bit brown, and put it around him, and he'd sit on a rock, you know, a bit elevated, and then all his friends would come and bring him things to eat. And he said, "That's why, from being a kid, he always liked the idea of being a monk." And that's what Ajahn Chah said, the reason why he became a monk. So monks have a great sense of humour, so it's really great to be around. Anyway, I did not have the strength to continue on because, you know, it's just, there's no reason not to be a monk. You're having a really wonderful time. Sometimes people think that, oh, being a monk is so difficult. Or being a nun, it's easy life, isn't it? It's wonderful. Freedom, peace, no husbands. I get in trouble sometimes because I was, what was it, that some Thai girls, I've known them for a long time, that's including Sifa and a few others I've known a long time. They're just around about the same age, and they didn't realize that I was the same age as those, many of those. I was 60, well, in Asian tradition, you always had a year, 67 this year. I said, well, I didn't realize you were so old, you look so young. I said, yeah, that's because I was never married. And they know, and they laughed, and yeah, damn, well, you shouldn't say things like that. But that's one thing. Look, many of you know me a long time. And, you know, sometimes you see me in all sorts of different situations. I'm enjoying myself. Happy monk. It's not just put on for you, you know, sort of, okay, just when I go back to my room in private, I lock the door. Oh, I hate this job. No. You're having a wonderful time. So you're enjoying yourself. So I think the word these days is authentic. You know, you've got to be true to who you are. So I enjoy this life. Why the time frame is very different from the human realm to the Deva world. For example, in the 33 gods realm, one day there is equal to 100 years in the human world. Is that the same minute by minute of the formation in Deva realm? Is slowed down to the point that just normal 24-hour day in the Deva realm is equal to the length of 100 years. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, the answer is yes, because what is time anyway? And the more you want, the more that time has a meaning and the faster it is. The more satisfied and content you are, the more that time has no meaning, it tends to slow down. So that's why sometimes some of you will get into some nice deep meditations, 3-4 hours pass by, and you haven't been asleep, you've been really alert. And 3-4 hours, I can't sit that long. But you look at the clock and it's true, you have actually meditated that long. So when you're peaceful, content, time has a different meaning to it. What is time anyway? It's always a distance between the past and the future, the past and the present, or the present and the future. When you're in the present moment, there's no past, there's no future, then time has no meaning. Isn't it wonderful? And we already mentioned about there being nothing and things disappearing. Time disappearing. That is really cool. But okay, now I'll do that another day. When I put food into the bowl of a good monk or nun, I get a hit of joy, gladness, or happiness. At times, the gladness makes me cry. Most of the time, it makes me smile a lot. I can't help it. What's happening? What's going on? It's giving. Giving is always gives you a lot of happiness. Any psychologist knows this. You give people $10 and tell one of them to give it to charity, to give it to someone who needs it. The other one is to spend it on yourself. Time and time again, you always get more happiness when you give it to somebody else. It's just giving is the source of happiness. So that's why it's great to be able to give things to people. Even there was what I learned. And I'm still a layperson this time. Somebody told me an anecdote of His Holiness the Dalai Lama before he left Tibet. And that was, as an American journalist, and managed to find his way into Tibet, and was following the Dalai Lama around, doing a little article, forget from where. But I got no record of this, I don't know where it was, but it's a very wonderful story. Got no reason to doubt its veracity, its truthfulness. But he was going to village after village after village, and people were lining up to give him stuff. And so he went into this one village, and a whole line of people, a very poor village, and then the journalist was following him, and the journalist just totally lost it, blew up, when this very poor woman, you know, really dirt poor, wearing rags, gave the Dalai Lama a skirt. That's all she had to give to him. And this journalist said, "No, I've been following you. You want for nothing. You get really nice food. You live in a nice quarters in Patala Palace. And this woman needs that skirt. You're a man. You never wear skirts. Why did you take that from her? She needs it much more than you." He really got angry at the idea of, like, you know, generosity and giving. And that's when the Dalai Lama just very calmly, when people scold you and offend you, you don't sort of, you know, say, you know, you should reflect upon that. He just was much wiser, just didn't move. And when it was time for him to speak, said, "It's true. I don't need that skirt. But that woman needed to give it to me." And do you get that? It's not that you need a skirt, but someone needed to give it something to, and that's all she had. When I heard that, you understand the joy of giving. It's not that, you know, that the monk needs or the nun needs more food, but you need to give it to be part of things. And this is such a beautiful thing. And when I hear that, oh, sometimes people give me all sorts of stuff. And sometimes, you know, I don't eat it, but I pass it on to someone I know will enjoy it. How many people here follow cricket? None of you. Crikey. Some of you are supposed to be Sri Lankan. Or Indian. But anyway, there was this, I think she was a grandmother of this Australian, Ashton Agar or something, who's, you know, plays for Australia now. But anyway, she was in hospital with cancer. So they asked me, you know, she's a very devout Buddhist, so can I go and visit her, cheer her up, give her some energy? So I went to go and visit her when I was in Melbourne. And, you know, she knew I was coming, and she knitted me a pair of socks. She did it by herself. Knitted a pair of socks for a month. And so, I never wear socks, look. Even when it's really cold, I don't wear socks. Even when I was in England, didn't wear socks. And even when I was in Korea, it was in minus 16 degrees in the snowfields, I just were walking there just without any socks. And, you know, it was a big event there. And so, the monk I was with was a really tough monk. You know, he was actually missing two fingers. Because you know what he did, you know, to prove just how powerful his mind was, he put his finger in a candle flame until it burnt off. And not just once, he did the other one as well, missing two fingers. And that was really tough, like, could you do that? But then, they'd seen that before, when they saw this Western monk walking through the snow. I had my shoes, but no socks on. And I was just, you know, mindfully walking. And because there was all these TV cameras, they were all focused on my feet. I had all these TV crews looking at my feet. How can you do that? I just got good circulation. It's okay. You know, you get a bit cold sometimes, but after a while you can't feel it anymore. So it's all the same. I'd rather do that than burn my fingers off. So I've got pretty famous feet in Korea. Crazy stories. Well, anyway, so she offered me some socks. And what did I do? I don't say I don't wear socks, throw them away. That's just really just so insensitive. Oh, thank you so much. And I put them on. And because I knew her room, because I could see the car park from her from the room window in the hospital. So I knew I had to go past there to go. So as I was walking out, thank you so much, that I remember just, I don't know if it's really appropriate for a monk, but like dancing, kicking up my legs so she could see my socks. as I walked outside to the cover, and I looked up and she was smiling her head off, seeing a monk who was just, you know, kicking up his legs, because he knew what I was up to. I was not really dancing, I was just showing off the socks. He's wearing my socks. And then later on I took them off and gave them to somebody who needed them more than I did. But that's actually how we deal with generosity. That's why you get so much fun, so much joy giving to somebody. So that's why if you get a gift, accept it. And if you don't want to use it yourself, just pass it on to somebody else. And that way the gift makes so much merit. Okay, it's wonderful. I'm on my now. All over the place. Oh, here we go. I was kicking up my legs. How to overcome gross unpleasant sensations. So overpowering that makes me open my eyes and stop my meditation. Then close your eyes again and start again. Or you can get the iPads, the eye shades. Now, they're all gone here, but there's a few more on the table there. So, gross unpleasant sensations. They'll either get worse or they'll get better. They won't stay the same. This too will pass. So, gross sensations happen. So, you can get up and move, scratch, whatever. And then just walk is always really good. And it goes away. It doesn't last. So, that's why it's unpleasant sensations. And if you just decide to stay there, I'm stronger than these, sometimes you can get very, very tense. Sometimes those unpleasant sensations are telling you something that you need to move. Sometimes they're just restlessness, and see if you can find out the difference between both of those. If it's really unpleasant, then just get up and do something about it. I feel like my thinking mind is like a monkey hanging on one branch and catching another. When I finish one thought, it feeds to another. This goes on, and while I meditate, help, monkey. Wouldn't it be wonderful to miss the branch? You've got nothing more to catch until you fall down. No more branches to catch onto. Do you ever do that? Real monkeys do. You know, one of those lovely little stories about generosity and monkeys springing from branches. You see statues of it every now and again in Buddhism. Have the Buddha statue and being a monkey on one side and an elephant on the other side. And it was the story when the monks in the village of Kosambi, which is now Allahabad, but a long time ago, there was a big Buddhist monastery there in Kosambi, and the monks had a disagreement. And it's only a tiny thing. And then they just, because the two parties, were both very senior, lots of disciples, and had a big argument, and then the Buddha heard there was an argument, and so he went there to try and settle it. You know what the monk said to him? He said, "Look, Buddha, you just go off and meditate. We'll sort this one out." That was just so disrespectful, which is what happens when you have arguments. So off he went, and he went off into the forest for 3 months. Into the jungle, the Parilaika forest. And there he met an elephant. And the elephant had also fed up with his herd for squabbling. And so the two of them spent the rains together. And the elephant would just go and get fruit for the Buddha and water as well. Because you know that things have to be offered for a monk or a nun. That can be animals. It's quite okay that an animal can actually offer stuff to a monk or nun. And in fact, there was this monk in Thailand. It was Ajahn Anaik, if anyone's seen this monk. And he, was an amazing monk. He trained a monkey to actually offer him things. And this monkey, the monk would sort of point to like a papaya up in the tree or a banana or some fruit in the tree, point to it. And the monkey would run up there, would get the mango, would come down and offer it to the monk, put his hand up and then bow 3 times. Just training this monkey to do. He was crazy. And then, of course, when you hear things like that, people went to the monastery just to see the monkey. They weren't interested in seeing the monks or learning about meditation or anything. And when Ajahn Chö heard about it, he said, "No, don't do that sort of stuff. It's not really right to train monkeys that way." But anyway, it's possible. So anyway, just the elephant would just get the fruit and even water for the Buddha for 3 months. And one day a little monkey was swinging through the tree and saw this. And the monkey thought, I want to get like a piece of the action. You know, he wanted to give something to this, you know, really great monk, the Buddha, sitting in the forest alone. So he swung through the trees and found some honey. Took the honey and presented it to the Buddha, who took it. And the monkey was just so overjoyed. It was just so blissed out, he went swinging through the trees without any mindfulness and missed a branch and fell down and died. And got immediately reborn in this really high heaven realm. And I can imagine that sometimes you get so overjoyed, oh, he's taking something from me, wow! And the monkey just swag. And eventually the monks in Koh Samui, they reconciled and they found the Buddha and asked him to come back. And they said, sorry, you know, people make mistakes. So the Buddha came back, and the poor elephant was just, the Buddha said, no, I have to leave now, but you know, now go and get some food for all the monks here. It's only about a delegation of a few monks here. So the elephant got lots and lots of fruits and fed all the monks, and then the monks had to leave, and the elephant died of a broken heart. He had the Buddha to himself for 3 months and fed all these beautiful, beautiful monks. And then the elephant got reborn in even a higher realm than the monkey. I don't know, I kind of like that story. It just, even elephants and monks and monkeys and stuff, you know, they sometimes get to know, you know, just being kind and just being gentle and giving. And they got this beautiful reward. So if you ever see a statue of the Buddha with the monkey and the elephant, that's the story behind it. I kind of like that one anyway. Anyway, so if you've got the monkey mind, just do some dana, be kind to yourself. And then after a while, the monkey mind will just stop. How to practice stillness and present moment with our eyes and ears constantly in contact during our daily social situations. It is when your daily social situations here are just very little. All you need to do is just, you know, you look at your food, you don't look at the person sitting next to you, and you don't talk, I hope. So it means over here you've got very little sensory impingement. And social situations, yeah, sometimes we have to be social, but a lot of times we don't. So we can actually choose to spend a lot of time in a little bit of solitude. You know, I was giving a lecture about, you know, Buddhism, mind, and dementia. And I was presenting with, you know, a doctor over in Singapore. He was a Buddhist, and he was a professor in that area. And when he started to say, you know, what, you know, the signs of dementia, you know, of actually losing it, he said, well, you know, you can't remember the past, you can't plan for the future, and you become socially disengaged. And I thought, oh my goodness, I've been teaching people to do that for the last 20 years. So there's a time you get socially engaged, and you listen and you talk. There's a time when you just become disengaged. Learning how to do both, that is a skill. Do we still need to concentrate or focus on our breath to practice stillness of mind? No. You just let go. And the breath comes up. I'll tell more about that tomorrow in the lotus and the stages of meditation. So more coming tomorrow. Can you please tell me how meditation can be used to keep dementia at bay? See, you have the focus on the, no, can't call it psychopaths. No one has actually done that study yet, because people always started to think, if you don't keep using it, you will lose it. And they have this idea of, oh, when you get old, you must keep interested in doing puzzles or crosswords or something, otherwise your brain will not get engaged. But, you know, I've seen people who just, you know, people like these great monks, really, really old, and they never get the dementia. But for me, it's like the practicing of mindfulness, keeping that mindfulness strong, lots of stillness, really sort of energized, and then dementia will not affect you. That is my theory. I've asked a lot of people, can't you do some experiments or just some track meditators to see if they get dementia at the same rate as non-meditators? Anyway, Atan, I can meditate better in my own room instead of the hall with the group, especially when the pain sensation arises. At times when it's so intense, I have difficulty to focus my attention on the breath, or it's because my meditation practice is incorrect. No, that's great. Meditate in your own room, because sometimes the peer pressure, you know, you think, oh, I've got to live up to other people's expectations, I can't move. And if you're in your own room, you can get sort of, it's about like being in your own cave. So you can actually adjust it just however you need. But after a while, you find the pain sensation, sometimes why does it arise? Sometimes, if it's very strong, then move. One of my friends, another friend, he's still a monk, this one, he decided to do the practice of meditating all night, not moving a muscle. So he meditated there, he actually made it through the night, about 12 hours without moving. And in the morning we had to take him to hospital. Absolutely true. Double knee reconstruction. Crazy. So, you know, there is some stupidity sometimes with people trying to be too tough. Trying to think that you can will your way past these things instead of like using your wisdom and compassion. Dear Ajahn, feelings is one of the five aggregates. If the feeling is neutral, this arises due to ignorance, not always. May I have your view on this, please? No, this, the upekā vedana. This is the neutral feeling in the fourth jhana, where it's the purity, the most powerful mindfulness you can ever have. So it is not due to ignorance at all. Also, this ignorance is the same as the ignorance of dependent origination. Ignorance tends to karma formations. But I don't like calling it ignorance, because many people have studied and know Pali, Sanskrit, they can recite the suttas, but they're still pretty stupid. So they know, but they don't understand. So instead of calling it ignorance, I much prefer delusion. And that's much closer when somebody asks the Sariputta, now what is avijja? And he says, it's seeing what is suffering as being happiness. And seeing what is happiness as being suffering. Seeing what is permanent as being impermanent. What is impermanent as being permanent. Seeing what has nothing to do with the self as a self. How can I apply the letting go out of meditation in daily life? Oh, in daily life, we do need a rest. Otherwise, you'll become a workaholic. So, when it's your lunch hour, let go of your work. When it's the time to rest, turn off your mobile device. Close it down. Let it go. So you own it, rather than it owning you. And when it's time to go to bed at night, just let go of your past and future. So you don't worry about your past and future. Here's another little joke which might offend people, but who cares, it's coming. About a man who went to the psychologist, and he said, I have such great anxiety that I don't sleep at night. I haven't finished it yet. I haven't come to the punchline. He said, I am just can't, I've got insomnia. I can't sleep at night. And it is, you know, because, you know, I've got so many troubles and anxieties. And he said, well, why do you take your troubles and anxieties, why do you take your worries and troubles into bed with you? And he said, because my wife refuses to sleep on the couch. Okay, it's a monk joke. Now, another psychiatrist joke, one of my, I think that's on the board. The squirrel? Squirrel's on the board, isn't it? Okay, the nuts, yeah, okay. How about the dog? The guy goes to the psychiatrist and said, sort of, what's your problem, sir? He said, I always think I'm a dog. The psychiatrist said, oh, just get on the couch. He said, I'm not allowed. Okay, that's enough. Ha, ha, ha. So how can you apply the letting go out of meditation in daily life? You have to do some letting go. We always do letting go. There's a time to let go, and there's a time to do things. If karma is intention, then if someone is intoxicated with alcohol or other substance, it ends up harming another, does this person not get any bad karma because it was not his intention to harm, but his intention to drink the alcohol in the first place? So because his intention was to drink the alcohol, then he's responsible. As an inspiring Buddhist, or aspiring, oh wait, or expiring Buddhist, can we invest in companies which produce war weapons and alcohol? Oh, not really, because that doesn't really make so many other things you can invest in if you've got any money. The best investment is karma. Invest in good karma. Can you please explain a little bit about the realm one experiences in jhanas? Yes, I will, but another time, because that fits in later on. Dear Ajahn, on the four foundations of mindfulness, what is the meaning of the contemplating the body as bodhin, ardent, clearly aware and mindful, having put aside hankering and fretting for the world? That makes no sense to most people. It's a very bad translation. Number one, contemplating the body as the body. It doesn't mean that at all. It is like a person who comes from a foreign land and they come across the phrase, it rained cats and dogs. And they really are quite amazed. And in the Western world, these little felines and canines, they drop from the sky. But that's what it says. It rained cats and dogs. It is an idiom. You do not translate word for word. You translate sentences, phrases. That is the unit of human speech. A word has no real meaning outside the sentence which contains it. So, contemplating the body as body, it doesn't mean that. It does body contemplation, body awareness. That's all it means. Body as body, body in the body. Anyone who knows any Pali knows that that's word for word translation. It means just being aware of the body. Stop. Ardent, clearly aware of what, and mindful, isn't that just saying the same thing? It's aware of the purpose. It's mindful with, it's called sampajanya. It literally means with wisdom. Mindfulness, wisdom. Why are you doing this? What's the purpose of it? And having put aside hankering and fretting for the world. What on earth does that mean? And it's really crazy that people still translate like that. If you know, it's called Vinaya Loke Abhija Domanasang. When I learnt my Pali and read the books myself, you know, read through the suttas, you came across those words again and again. Loke Abhija was a synonym for Karma Chanda, which all you Pali experts here know means the first hindrance. Domanasa, two suttas, it's a synonym for the second hindrance, vayapada, ill will. You see it there. And then I looked in the commentaries for the two Satipatthana suttas, Mahasatipatthana, and the other Satipatthana in number 10 of the Majjhima. My goodness, the commentaries said exactly the same. Loke Abhija means the first hindrance. Domanasa, what do you have here? Fretting. Is it, or they usually call it grief. It's covetousness and grief for the world. The covetousness for the world, those two words go together, and the grief. It's Loke Abhija and Domanasang. There's similes for the two hindrances. And the commentaries say that where you see the two hindrances mentioned, the two of any group, it's the idioms, it means the rest as well. It means the whole group. So when you have the two main characters, everything else in this common group is also included. So they say, the commentators say that those words, Lokya, Bija, Dhamma, Nasang, mean the five hindrances. And Vinaya, it means having suppressed, having weakened, what I call having restrained the five hindrances. And that makes so much sense. You restrain the five hindrances first before you can be mindful. Otherwise, you know, you want something, you don't see what's there, you just see what you want to see. And ill will, you don't really sort of see, so there's a human being in there, you just want to destroy something. You see again, we're only part of what's there, you're not really mindful, you're not clearly aware. And it's the same with sloth and torpor, you're too dull to see things. Restlessness, you're all over the place. And just even doubt is a form of restlessness. You can't really see anything, you're just always thinking about, is this right, is this wrong, whatever. And so this is actually what that means. So before you do the satipatthana, you've got to restrain the hindrances. How do you do that? By having right view, right intention, and the right intention, not the right thought. That's again, that's another stupid, I shouldn't say stupid, it's another inaccurate translation. It's your motivation, where you're coming from. You know what second factor of the Eightfold Path, right, motivation is? Second factor of the right Eightfold Path? Letting go, being kind, being gentle. Nekama sankapa Nekama sankapa avayapada sankapa ahingsaka sankapa. Otherwise meaning letting go, being kind, being gentle. Sometimes I call it making peace, being kind, being gentle. When you come from that, then all your precepts come in place. And then you just, you know, from that you have this right endeavor, you know, which is, you know, to stop the unwholesome things coming in and create wholesome things. That is how you restrain the hindrances. So those first parts of the Eightfold Path are there as a preparation before you do Satipatthana. And then, as you restrain the hindrances through Satipatthana, they overcome through Satipatthana. They overcome through the jhanas. And then you can see things as they truly are. That's how it all works together, and I'm sure I'll expand upon that later on. But that's the meaning of it, and sometimes they're just, the translations of that. People who didn't really know English didn't know how to translate either. Ajahn Brahm, in present moment awareness, does not think about the past or the future. Does this mean that whatever is in front of you, prominent, whether it's sound, sensation, pain, or five hindrances, you make that the object of meditation with kindness and patience? Excellent. Well done. Then one piece is established, naturally moves on to the breath. You don't move anywhere, but just it evolves onto the breath. So the term letting be means being kind or whatever the above until I'm able to let go and move on to the breath. It also means doing nothing, leaving things alone. That's good enough. Well done. Yep. 9.5 out of 10. Could you please explain the fear of letting go, its causes? Yes. Letting go of what you attach to is fear. So, sometimes you're about to die. Yeah, I don't want to die, I'm too young. No one's too young to die. What are you afraid of dying for? You've done it many times before, it's pretty cool. Why are you afraid? Because you're attached to something. So every time fear comes up in the meditation, great. You're at the cold face of detaching, the place where you understand what your attachments really are. But of course, there's some attachments, you know, which is not that hard to let go of, you know, family. But then you get some deep attachments, your body. Why are you afraid of letting go of your body in meditation? I told you, you've seen that so many times that when you're in deep meditation, nothing can harm you. Yes. Being a monk, you come across some really cool characters every now and again. But, you know, when they're still alive, you're not really supposed to tell all the weird stuff they do. But this fellow, he's dead now, he's called Sudarmo. He was an Indonesian monk, and I knew him reasonably well. And he had such a cool story that when he started off as a monk, before he was a monk, he decided to be like a rishi, like a hermit. So he went into the jungles in Java when there was still really jungles there, in the middle of nowhere, and just in the jungle, sat down under a tree. And this is what he told me. He said he sat down, he started meditating, just really letting go. And he said this huge star came into his mind. And because his English wasn't the best, he said he married that star, united with it. And then when he came out of his meditation, he didn't know how long he'd been meditating, but the jungle, the forest around him was different. And he asked the villagers, he'd been there for days meditating, about 5 or 6 days or something, and there'd been a flood. And he'd been submersed underwater, a couple of meters of water, for days. Totally fine. Didn't really know what was going on. Perfectly invulnerable. And so, you know, you can't drown. You can't be burnt. Nothing can affect you in those deep meditations. Weird, but true. And I remember seeing that. And that guy had some really strong powers. So, anyway, one thing he did, which was spooky, but the lady who knew this, she was, a granddaughter of one of the kings of Thailand, a princess, what's it called? Not Mom Luang, Mong Ratchawong. Yeah, Mom Ratchawong. But anyway, she was a good friend, and she's a bit of a rebel, but she started learning meditation. So in Wat Bawan, central Thailand, this monk was teaching a class once a week. And the last time she went there, she freaked out because she realized that something was happening. So she opened her eyes during the meditation. And, this woman would not lie to me. Rays of light were coming out of this monk's eyes into one of the meditators. Laser eyes. And I've got no reason to doubt that because I know that monk. Really powerful. Really juicy. Not just reading mind and other stuff, which sometimes, just coincidence. But just real juicy psychic powers. Laser eyes. But people, I like to see that. Would you? You'd be scared so much. So that's why fear comes up, fear of letting go and its causes. Going to places you never, a lot of times people are too scared to actually to do things like that. Or even actually see things like that. You're letting go. Letting go of your world view. Seeing things which will totally overturn the way you look at life. Sometimes we're not ready for that. Say for more about that, everyone. After how many years of practice did you first experience jhana? How frequently do you encounter them now? I'll say that later on. That's about the jhanas. How does one practice see the seven factors of enlightenment? I'll say that later on. Because it comes up in other talks, which I'm going to mention later on. When I meditate in the evening, I'm unable to sleep afterwards. How do I overcome this? Ha ha ha. This is so common in these meditation retreats. They say that in the evening, when they go back, they can't go to sleep. But when they come up here during the day, you're all half asleep. So, when you understand, when you try to meditate, you fall asleep. When you go to bed, you stay awake. The answer is obvious. When you come here to meditate in the morning or in the afternoon, especially when it's warm, try to go to sleep. And you'll be clear awake. When you go to bed after this, try to meditate in bed. And you'll fall fast asleep. Easy. Because what it is, you're trying to meditate. That's why you get tired. When you go to bed, you're trying to go to sleep. That's why you can't. So just give up and just try and meditate instead. Try and stay awake. It actually works, you know. It's really weird, human beings. Okay, the last question. The other ones, I promise I will do later on. So whatever's in this bowl here, just please don't throw them away. City question today. If the brain metabolizes less energy when one begins to meditate, then will one get fatter than one already is? Exactly. That is my problem. Because, you know, you give me food, and I said, well, like with socks, or with, you know, because I don't really need to eat it, but you need to give it to me. And because I don't metabolize that much, my brain is just don't worry about, I should worry some more. People who worry a lot, they do get thin. So because you don't worry so much, your brain gets very peaceful, it doesn't metabolize, it's got to go somewhere. But actually, no, that's not because of metabolism. The real reason that this is not fat. It's not fat. Stop laughing. I've been a monk now for over 43 years now. It's 44th year coming up. 43 years and a bit I've been a monk. And as a monk, you know, you practice compassion, kindness. You know that. You see me being kind, compassionate to everybody. Because you have so much compassion, every year as a monk, your heart grows a little bit bigger. Now, many years ago, it pushed against my rib cage. It couldn't go any further. So as my heart grew bigger and bigger, it pushed down and out. This is not fat. It's a big heart. It's got to go somewhere. It just goes out here, so it's a big heart, okay? And it's also true, you know, if you find thin people, how many thin, compassionate people do you really know? Fat, jolly ones. Before I became even a Buddhist, there was two, like, icons in religion, which I really looked up to. People I wanted to emulate. So if I'm going to be religious or join some sort of, you know, religious organization, these are the two people I will look up to. Now, one of them you might not remember because it was a long time ago. It was a fellow called Friar Tuck in Robin Hood. Do you remember him? He was always fat, really jolly, but just so kind. Friar Tuck. And the other one, was, and this fellow was just so kind, always fat, very jolly, and so generous. He was known worldwide for his generosity, and he was so healthy. He was old when I was young, and he was still alive today. Santa Claus. Have you ever seen a thin Santa Claus? Of course you haven't. He's fat, he's jolly, and he's happy. So, I always say that, never trust a thin monk or a thin nun. They must be worrying too much. Anyway, that's just having a bit of funny games. Excellent. But Ajahn Chah was fat. So was my preceptor, Somdet Buddhajan. So lots of people. But there is some downsides to that as well because, you know the rules in Theravada, you're not supposed to, you know, women aren't supposed to touch monks, men aren't supposed to touch nuns. But I was actually, it was Chinese New Year at Dhammaloka Center. You know, this stuff is crazy. And I was just, you know, Chinese New Year, I was just talking to people, just standing, just, you know. And this Chinese lady came and took one look at me and my fat belly. You know what she did? She started rubbing it for good luck. She rubbed my belly for good luck. I don't know, it didn't give me any good luck, but maybe for her. Anyway, there we go. So, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, so these other questions, you know, the bit deeper questions, I will answer them tomorrow. Very good, so have a beautiful night. And remember, if you can't go to sleep tonight, try to meditate in bed.